Good morning. How are y'all doing this morning? My name is David Castile, and I work for the Texas Department of Transportation out of San Antonio, and I'm glad y'all decided to join us this morning. We've had a wonderful little forum, and I hope y'all enjoyed the governor's speech last night. The governor of the great state of Texas gave us an inspiring speech about getting there, and he gave some examples of when he was in Haskell County, Texas, and growing up around Paint Creek, and we have some folks who've probably been to Paint Creek in the room. I've been to Paint Creek. I used to call football out of the Abilene district, and I called some six-man football games in Paint Creek, and you need to go there if you haven't been there. But he talked on a bigger scale about getting there from where we are. He talked about a world with less congestion, freer flow, even a more robust economy, cleaner air, and safer streets. And that's what we're here to talk about a little bit this morning. As you know, congestion, fixing congestion has a cost. And we hear a lot about that in the legislature, the cost to build roads, the cost to add bridges, the cost to maintain the highway. Every commission meeting you hear somebody talk about how much it will cost to fix this or fix that. What we want to concentrate on this morning is what it costs if we don't fix it, what the opportunity costs lost are, what the real cost of congestion is. The Texas Transportation Institute tries to do a little bit of that every year, too, with their urban mobility report. And in 2003, they threw out some numbers that will scare you. And for the Austin area, the cost of congestion alone, according to TTI, was over $390 million. And that's in 2003. We know it's all gotten considerably different since then. In my hometown of San Antonio, it's over $400 million. And for our two mega metro areas in Dallas, Fort Worth, and Houston, the cost of congestion, the delay time loss of productivity in those two metropolitan areas is over $2 billion a year. We have a huge problem. We have to fix it. And we brought together a most esteemed group to talk to us about these issues. We brought the chairperson of the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, Kathleen White. Thank you so much. We brought with us the division director from the Federal Highway Administration, Jen Brown. We brought a leader in the business community with Mr. Bill Hammond. And we're going to, if it's okay with everyone, and if it's okay with our speakers, we'll let each speaker come up, and I'll introduce them individually, and then they'll give a small presentation, and then we'll all come back as a panel and allow you to pose questions to this esteemed group and have a good discussion about lost opportunity and a good discussion about how we can get there. So with that, Chairman... Chairperson White, would you like to go first?
Certainly.
Okay. If you'll allow me just a moment, and I lost my trifocal, so I'm down to single vision, so excuse me. Chairperson White has been the chair of the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality since 2003 and has served on that commission since 2001. And when the governor talked about rural Texas and Paint Creek, the chairperson, she's probably thinking that's urban Texas because she's from Ballantyne. Chairperson White owns a 115-year-old ranch and operation in Jeff Davis and Presidio counties. Besides her work at TCQ, she also sits on the boards of the Texas Water Foundation and the Texas Natural Resource Foundation. A writer and consultant on environmental laws, natural resource policy, and ranching history, White received her bachelor and master's degrees from Stanford University. She also studied comparative religion at Princeton University and law at Texas Tech. Chairperson White and her colleagues at the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality are invaluable partners with TxDOT and our business community in developing our transportation network. Please welcome our first speaker, Chairperson Kathleen White.
Thank you very much. Good morning. I don't know whether I even try to wear my glasses because they're still fogged. Just makes me seem like somewhere I was in Asia once in a tropical environment right down here in downtown Austin. I'm going to make a few kind of big picture remarks that I think fit well within the topic of the cost of congestion. And in the work that the TCEQ has done worked on for years, but concluded in the last few months adopting the first 8-hour, 85 part per billion ozone sips revealed a whole lot to us about how mobile sources and congestion as a part of the issue with mobile sources is more and more a driver in the very challenging air quality issues Texas has in an effort to meet ever stricter ozone standards. These were the state plans, for the first time under the new, what's called the 8-hour, 85 part per billion ozone standard, replacing what was the 1-hour, 120 part per billion. You could talk for 6 days about what exact differences between those standards, but the 85, 8-hour is much stricter. EPA has proposed an ever more stricter standard. It's not concluded, but it's somewhere between 60 and 80. So it's just amazing how the ratcheting down that occurs. But the point about mobile sources and congestion is, for decades, the state, and really every state in the country that has these challenges, has focused on industrial point sources, regulating them, stimulating ever more effective technological controls on point sources, major point industrial sources. We've pretty much got all the low-hanging fruit, where, for instance, in Houston with the massive petrochemical complex, the main ozone driver emission, nitrogen oxide, is regulated now 80% less than what it used to be. Way down, extraordinary controls. Even in Houston, which people think as a heavy industrial center, there are far more mobile sources of ozone than there are industrial sources. Dallas, a city with far, far, far less industrial sources, has like 75% mobile sources. The state has said we don't have the regulating mobile sources, and that means engines and fuels. Is a federal authority that the state doesn't have. But because we are mandated by the federal law to achieve that air quality standard with whatever tools we have, we've done creative things in Texas. We have a boutique fuel, which I have resisted, but we have, and it's working, called Texas Low Emission Diesel, that's just in the pump now for all counties east of I-35. And we have something that most other states and the federal government can't believe we did. We've developed a fund from fees imposed on all Texans now, largely through a $15 or $20 increase for every title fee. That's, we thought it would generate about $120, $130 million a year, and that's how the legislature appropriated and authorized our use of that money. Well, the economy's so good, and people are buying vehicles so much that it's generating $170 to $200 million a year. And you all, and I don't know the extent to which people deal with this, we utilize that money to give grants up to sometimes 80% of the cost of heavy-duty equipment typically used in road construction or vehicles, heavy-duty vehicles. Amazing program. But mobile sources of emission, and somehow figuring out in all the ways, engines, fuels, ever cleaner, newer engines, but in transportation planning, how we can achieve those standards. It's not, there's very little left to pull off industry. We mobiled eliminating all the industrial sources on the ship channel. What would the air quality be? We weren't anywhere near. We modeled the much pointed at kilns in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, no impact, eliminating them, no impact. It's mobile sources, not only in their quantity, but in the nature of ozone formation. So how the state, and with all our partners in TxDOT and in full transportation community, figures out how to be most creative and most effective in figuring out what is, I hear, often called intelligent transportation planning. And I'm not a transportation planner. I can vaguely idea of what that means. But all the ways you eliminate congestion and you keep vehicles moving, engineers can do very interesting calculations of the ever greater quantity of emission, and not only just the volume of the more emissions you get from startup and idling and repeated acceleration, but what's the nature of ozone formation at the ground level. It's a tremendous driver. Stop and start, what goes on the kind of streets we have around here. And it's not just the volume of emission, but what goes on. I would like to hope this is a good time for the state, both with our partners in TxDOT, and the entire transportation road construction community to sit back and figure out how we can utilize the resources we have in this state the most effectively. And the one that jumps to mind is the one I just mentioned, TERP. The agency will now have appropriated about $170 million a year to use on these TERP grants. Many in this room probably remember what the impetus for this fund was many years ago when I wasn't there, so of course I can't be blamed, but I probably would have been dealing with the very same thing if I had. But in an effort to find more and more reductions in these ozone driving emissions, there was this great idea that that TCEQ, through our authority, would regulate time of road construction, what we used to call the construction shift ban or something, to try to prevent emissions at certain key commuting times, really, in the morning and the late afternoon. And there was extreme resistance to this, and I can totally understand why. I think when any part of government regulates the time within which you work, you get into a really, really, really problematic situation. But there was this idea to generate a very big fund, some of the fees of which would come from some of these sources. We call them non-road mobile sources, heavy-duty equipment that is off-road or non-utilized off-road or non-road. And through fees on some of those sources and from other fees, we generate this very large fund, which we call TERP, Texas Emission Reduction Program. And we would utilize to make grants for the lion's share of purchase of new equipment, which the best way to reduce these emissions is just keep buying what's ever new, because every year the engine standards now, both for light-duty and heavy-duty vehicles, as well as engines all the way to 2013, get cleaner and cleaner and cleaner and cleaner. But the state would give very generous grants to do so. And we have for now, I guess, 4 years. But again, on this, too, we wonder whether we're not getting the kind of grant applications we'd like to see, the quantity of them. And we're the last couple rounds, boy, if you looked at the list of all the grants of millions and millions and millions of dollars, they're one truck, two trucks, 75-80% of the cost of a $250,000 heavy-duty truck. And I wonder, and I think this is an important time to sit back, all of those that could figure out how we can perhaps more effectively utilize this money. And there are rubrics in law. We can't use it for anything and everything, but there are broader rubrics given to us from the last legislative session to utilize this fund. And I think that this is a key time for all those involved in that to sit back. No other state or the federal government has anything like this huge pot of money coming in every year. And so it's very exciting. It's a daunting responsibility to spend it right, but I think we should all put our heads together and figure out. And just, I'm going to kind of close because we have many other speakers here and perhaps there will be questions afterwards, but back to my initial point, now we realize so vividly that if it's going to be possible for large urban areas with growing populations and growing economies to meet these ever, ever stricter federal air quality standards, particularly that on ozone, it's going to be through mobile sources. We have already set by federal rule all of these dates that are tiered through 2013 largely for new engines affecting everything. And we already have now in place a federal clean fuel, ultra-low sulfur diesel. We have various other fuels, like our Texas low-emission diesel, which is even cleaner. But until there's more technological breakthrough and major change at the federal level, we know what we're going to get from cleaner engines and from these fuels. And I really think the next chapter is how we utilize intelligent transportation systems to ratchet down as far as we can. And the one thing that has to remain is a good economy, because that's what it's buying those new vehicles. it's more and more purchase of new vehicles not only gives us more TERP money in the title fee, but it that the engines are so much cleaner, both for off-road equipment as well as for any kind of vehicles, and that has to maintain. But I think this is, as we move forward, and in this state, a real time for those at TxDOT, most intelligent about this, and those at TCEQ, where I work, to sit down and really figure out how, with a lot of our major urban local governments, figure out how we can try to make a real leap forward eliminating congestion issues. Thank you.
Chairperson White, thank you so much, and it's obvious that TCEQ is in good hands with great leadership there, and her message was very clear. They're fixing the fuel, they're fixing the engines, they're replacing the equipment. We have to keep the cars moving. Thank you so much for that challenge, and we're up to it, and we're going to do it together. As the governor said, together we're going to do it. Our next speaker is Jan Brown. Jan's my newest friend here in Texas. She got here as fast as she could. She came to us from Montana, and she's the director of our Federal Highway Division here in Texas, and you'll pardon my glasses one more time. Jan comes to us, I think it's called the Treasure State. I've always heard it's the Big Sky State of Montana, and she came here in January, and of course she's called Texas home, and she took over the reins of the Texas Division of the Federal Highway Administration. In her work at the FHWA, she directs the advancement of public-private partnerships to fund major transportation improvement. She is also a major proponent of helping the state upgrade its transportation network, including border connections that support increased international freight movement between the United States and Mexico. As I mentioned, Jan comes to us directly from the Montana Division of Federal Highway Administration, but she's also worked for that agency in the District of Columbia and the headquarters office out in California, Missouri, New York, and Washington State. Please welcome our friend, our partner, and a great leader, Division Director Jan Brown.
Thank you very much, David, for that generous introduction. I've only been in the state for 5 months now, and I every day brings a new surprise to me, and I have to share with you two of my surprises for this morning. The first is that when Mike Behrens called me in early March, he said, "We'd like you to come to the Transportation Forum and speak at one of our little breakout sessions." So my first surprise is I come this morning and I see this big room. If this is your idea, I know everything's big in Texas, but I guess even your small breakout sessions are large. So that was my first surprise. My second surprise was, as I'm racing down here this morning for the session, I left my purse back in my office, and David may have one part of his trifocals, and Kathleen has at least fogged glasses. I, unfortunately, have no glasses, so that may be fortunate for you because I may not be able to read my notes. What I wanted to do today, if I can advance this, okay, is really to provide you an overview of what is going on at the national level from the USDOT and from federal highways in particular. Here's a quote from Secretary Mary Peters. "Mobility is one of our nation's greatest freedoms, but congestion limits predictable and reliable movement of people and goods." We all know that, and key in on that. Reliability. We can measure congestion in any number of ways. We can measure it in delay. We can measure it in speed. We can measure it in level of service. But basically, what people are most concerned about is the reliability of their system. And I can attest to the fact that whether you're in Austin, Texas, or Helena, Montana, if the system breaks down and you cannot get to where you think you're going in the time that you think you're going to get there, you're going to be frustrated by congestion. I'm going to figure this out. Okay. I was also asked not to spend so much time and dwell so much on the costs of congestion, because we all know what the costs of congestion are. but to spend most of my time talking about solutions. But I don't think that you really can talk about solutions until you understand the problems and understand why FHWA and USDOT are so concerned about the congestion that's occurring across the nation today. There is a figure out there, an estimated $200 billion costing Americans every year. We know that it reduces the very economic engine of this country and diminishes the benefits that we get from a good transportation system. It comes in lost productivity because of the increased costs of time spent in traffic. It decreases fuel efficiency, increases vehicle maintenance, decreases air quality, which Kathleen really talked about. And most important to every single one of us is the precious time that we all spend in traffic that we could otherwise be spending with our friends, our families, in community and civic activities. So let's talk about some of the causes of congestion. Certainly, one of the overlying or fundamental causes of congestion are really the lack of a way to manage the use and the efficient. Thank you very much. I knew if I said something that somebody would come up with some reading glasses. Thank you. That will help tremendously. Really, the fundamental causes are there's no mechanism to manage the use and prevent the gridlock that's occurring, and then the price of highway travel itself is not commensurate with and bears no relationship to the cost of congestion. You look at the pie chart here, and basically the basic causes or the areas of congestion, you can see that the big ones are capacity constraint. We need more roads, right? Or we need at least to better fix some of the bottlenecks that we have out there. But traffic incidents is another big player there, as well as work zones and bad weather. Point being here, I think that one of the things that Mary Peters, when she came and was administrator to the Federal Highway, she identified several focus areas for the Federal Highway Administration and the resources that we have, and two of those were safety and congestion. And in many ways, safety and congestion go hand in hand. If you can deal with and reduce the number of fatalities, the number of crashes out there, you're going to help the congestion issue, because so much of that congestion problem is in traffic incidents, is in work zones, is in the fact that people are driving in bad weather and are having crashes. So there's a lot to be done in that area, just a tremendous amount of opportunity for where we're going here. You're going to make sure I do this right. Okay. So Federal Highways, again, has been working on this an awful long time, and certainly several of the opportunities that we saw there and are working on today in the urban congestion problem is in creating urban partnerships, working with our urban centers to try to deal with how do you control the demand that's out there? How do you manage the system in its most efficient way? We are promoting HOV to hot conversion, the high occupancy vehicle to the hot high occupancy toll conversions, and Safety Lou does provide some flexibilities there in our program. We're looking at trying again to move the operations aspect of our transportation system into the planning process and implement meaningful congestion management processes. And then finally, really putting an emphasis on reducing the impacts of bottlenecks. The big button. All right. Okay. So why now? USDOT also, as much as Federal Highways is working on this, this too is a USDOT initiative. It goes across modes and is not just surface transportation, but we're also seeing problems in our airports and our ports as well. And really what it is a matter of surging public discontent with the congestion, the pork barrel projects out there. We've got new advances of technology that we need to take advantage of. We see that nationwide we're just losing ground in our competitiveness, and we need to get a handle on and do better in the congestion that we have. Those economic benefits of trucking, rail, and aviation deregulation have really started to diminish. And so USDOT is really looking toward putting an emphasis on this. So they have announced, and I'm sure many of you are already familiar with, the USDOT's six-point congestion plan. The first one is to create those urban partnership agreements, and I will spend most of my time today talking about not only the urban partnership agreements, but what are some of the opportunities in addition to that, that those who aren't partners also have many opportunities to reduce urban congestion. I also will spend a little bit of time, because, again, Federal Highways is involved in it, in the area of the Corridors of the Future competition that's ongoing as we speak. Urban partnership agreements. This was, again, an initiative that was started by USDOT last fall. Basically, USDOT was in search for and is in search for up to 1 to 5 cities that are willing to implement four broad policies. One, implementing broad congestion pricing within their boundaries, looking at the new and expanded bus rapid transit in their areas, working with employers to expand telecommuting and flexible work schedules and possibly getting agreements with the major employers in a metropolitan area, and then looking at technology and operation strategies that, again, will increase the efficiency of the system. I will tell you that there has been, I know that many of us wondered if there would be cities who would come forward, particularly in that congestion pricing area. One of the things that the United States is and the administration is quite interested in is taking some of the experiences of our European countries and bringing them here to the United States, particularly in that congestion pricing area, and see if we can get some cities to try some of the things that have been tried overseas. And there has been significant interest in the program. Congestion pricing and urban partnership agreement workshops were held earlier this year in several of the major cities. And there is a website that does talk more to this. I will tell you that right now, the finalists on June 6th, a list of 9 finalists were announced for this competition. Atlanta, Dallas is one of them as well, Denver, Miami, Minneapolis, St. Paul, New York City, San Diego, San Francisco, and Seattle. They're going through a process now of interviews and working with teams in headquarters, in our headquarters office in Washington, D.C., in the second phase of this competition. And USDOT anticipates that they will select ultimately 1 to 5 of these 8 cities for urban partnerships. And that announcement is expected on or before August 8th. What's in it for the partners, you may ask, and to the maximum extent possible? We're not talking about any new money for these cities at all, but what it is doing is putting a priority out there for some of the discretionary programs that USDOT may be able to cobble together and try to prioritize some of the activity that these particular cities may be interested in trying. DOT has also offered... well, right now they're offering up to $130 million in urban partnership funding and have also asked in the 2008 budget for another $100 million. That's not a lot of money, but in addition, USDOT is offering some flexibility, regulatory flexibility, and also they're looking at also the expertise and the personal resources that are available within all of the agencies within USDOT. In addition to the urban partnerships, as I said, there are many things that all of us can do in many of the major metropolitan areas. Certainly, FHWA is out promoting HOV to hot conversions. There is an FHWA expert task force. There's plenty of guidance out there on the internet, on our website, that does talk about conversions. And we are available to provide technical support as well. I mentioned the meaningful congestion management processes. Again, trying to bring operations into the planning process and look at strategies, making sure that there are strategies in the planning process, in our transportation plans, in for for managing and getting the most out of our system. There are requirements in Safety Lou, and all of the transportation, the management areas greater, the urbanized areas greater than 200,000 are required to have a congestion management system. So that will be part of the certification reviews. Reducing the impacts of bottlenecks. Again, these what FHWA is putting on an emphasis on right now is really looking at those spot areas that are really causing some real bottlenecks in areas. In 2006, all of the states were asked to identify their top bottleneck areas for congestion. And out of that, FHWA has now visited three states that are really doing what we believe are kind of the front runners in dealing with some of these spot congestion improvements and looking for some low-cost improvements. They've visited Maryland, Florida, and Washington State. And with that experience, they've put together a primer which was just published last week and is now available on our website. And so, again, it's lessons learned, but through that mechanism, also developing a peer exchange process where getting people to talk about the congestion problem and what are some of the solutions out there and share what works and what doesn't work. So this is something that's growing, certainly something that we're working toward, and we're asking every state really to identify one bottleneck this year that they will work on, and again, share what their experience is, what they've learned, what has worked for them. So hopefully through this peer exchange process, we'll be able to share those experiences better and learn from each other. Let's move finally into operational and technological improvements. Again, there are several areas here. The areas of providing better traveler information so people can make better decisions, improving our work zones, improving our management of incidents, that non-recurring type activity out there that really messes up with the system reliability. So really doing a better job in incident management. And finally, there are opportunities still in traffic signal timing. Real-time traveler information, what we're talking about here and what FHWA is working toward is nationwide 501 deployment. And that's something, as you, if you look on a map of the states that have deployed 511, certainly most of the western states are certainly out there and have 501. I don't believe Texas has it yet. So certainly we'll be talking with our partners there to try to, again, bring 911 nationwide. Travel time on urban, the variable message signs out there, and we certainly have activities there that are occurring here in Texas, and then real-time traveler information programs. Implementing work zone, again, there is a new rule out there that is effective this October, and really looking at trying to improve our work zone safety and mobility. Again, remember, I said earlier that safety and mobility go hand in hand. If we can really improve safety of our work zones, that's going to help us in the congestion issue too, in the non-recurring congestion that occurs out there and is such a big piece of that congestion puzzle. So, again, what that rule does is really try to institutionalize and bring work zone safety, work zone management, and plan into the planning and entire project development process. And finally, reduce incident delay. Again, many opportunities here, and really what FHWA is promoting is that states have the policies in place to be able to deal with and get that incident off the road. We're promoting move-it laws in states, quick clearance policies, full-function service patrols that are out there, and really looking at an integrated transportation law enforcement technology and what we can do to better manage an incident when it does occur. Okay. And finally, it's that improve the traffic signal timing. Some of our traffic signals out there were timed in with traffic patterns that were existed long ago and haven't been updated. And really, the point here being that we need to be aware of and constantly assessing the traffic patterns that are out there and really work at trying to improve and get the most we can out of the signal timing process and really get the system working efficiently. I'm missing a slide, and that slide is on the corridors of the future. I think we all know that congestion isn't just an urban problem. It is, in fact, occurring in our urban in our corridors, as well as we try to move people and goods across this nation. And so the other initiative that is out there under USDOT umbrella that FHWA is working on is the Corridors of the Future. Again, that was a solicitation of interest that went out last fall, and in February there were about 14 of the 38 proposals that were submitted were invited to submit applications for Corridors of the Future. And those applications were due in late May, and again, the process is in its selection process now with teams going over the proposals, and we anticipate that after the urban partnership agreements are announced, that we will shortly thereafter see an announcement of which corridors will be selected that designation as a corridor of the future. Again, we're not talking about new money so much as really putting the focus in on those areas that really can help this nation move people and freight more efficiently than they do today. And so on that last slide, I really did provide you the, and I probably should back up, hopefully, and leave those up there a little bit longer. Those are the websites that will provide you a wealth of information. I think what I'd like to say is really that congestion isn't and doesn't need to be a fact of life. There is much, much that we can do. I think USDOT believes it, FHWA believes it, and that we can sit around and talk and complain about congestion all we want, but until we put a plan in place and actually do something about it, we're not going to see any differences. So.
You see, we have a partner willing to help us. No money, but willing to help us. So the chairperson, she said, it's our job to keep Texas moving, to keep the cars moving. Jan said she's ready to help. Now let's get down to business. Our next speaker is Bill Hammond. Bill is the... for more than 10 years, he has led Texas efforts to improve the state's business climate and its economy. He's done a great job. We are the business state in this nation. Bill Hammond is the president and chief executive officer of the Texas Association of Businesses and Chambers of Commerce. Before coming to that post, he was chairman of the Texas Workforce Commission. He's also served the state of Texas as a House of Representatives. And during his tenure in the 80s, he authored the Texas Education Agency Sunset Bill. While he was in the House, he was named one of the state's top 10 legislators by the Texas Monthly and the Dallas Morning News. As the person who represents Texas business, he is uniquely qualified to help us understand that we have to keep Texas moving, we have to face the governor's challenge, we have to get there. Please welcome Bill Hammond.
Thank you, David. I appreciate the kind introduction. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today and talk about this critically important issue to business and the economy and the future of Texas. The mission of the Texas Association of Business is to create the best business climate on the planet so that when businesses make a decision about where to locate or where to expand, the answer will be Texas. You know, it's all about creating good jobs with good wages and good benefits. And our job is to speak to the legislature and speak to the state agencies. And I speak as a recovering member of the Texas House and a recovering bureaucrat to tell them about things that help bring capital to this state. The legislature can do things, as we witnessed this last session, I'll get to it more extensively later, can do things to make capital flee. Or they can do things to bring capital to the state. And when capital comes to the state, we all win, because it means more jobs with good wages and good benefits for the people of Texas. My wife and I have three children. Actually, one of them's actually employed now. The other two are in various stages of education, but at some point in time, we hope they will finish. And when they do, we hope that they, if they choose to, there's a job waiting for them in Texas, because we want them to come home from time to time, but we don't want them coming home for extended periods of time. So I hope you'll work with us to build the economy of Texas so that the Hammond children can find work. I've also explained to them that I expect a 10% tithe for the rest of their lives, but I'm not having that much success with that program. If any of you have had that success in regards to that, please seize me after my speech. Now, you know, like I said, the mission is to create the best business climate on the planet, and sometimes our issues are difficult. You know, our side of the issue cannot be the 15-second soundbite. You know, it's more complicated. And I'm reminded of the story of the two young boys who one morning wake up and say to each other, or the older son, of course, is always in the lead, and he said to his younger brother, today is the day we're going to curse. We're going to begin cursing. And, of course, the younger brother follows the lead of the older brother. And they go downstairs, and mom turns to one of the boys and says, would you like some Wheaties or would you like some Cheerios? And the son says, well, I guess I'll have some damn Cheerios. And so, of course, mom is very upset with this, distraught. She grabs the kid by the scruff of the neck, takes him upstairs, slam, bam, you hear this. A few minutes later, she comes back down, and she turns to the other young man and says, would you like some Wheaties or would you like some Cheerios? And he says, I sure as hell don't want any Cheerios. You know, the idea of, if you will, I thought about this morning, trading land for capital, if you will. I mean, Texas has been rich in resources in terms of people, obviously, natural resources, land, agriculture, on and on and on. But one of the things that we've had a deficit in over the years is capital. And our forefathers, recognizing that there was a deficit in capital more than 100 years ago now, traded land for the construction of our capital. And the reason that we have the most beautiful, most magnificent capital of all 50 states is that our forefathers figured out that it made a good deal for Texas to swap some land in the panhandle in return for this construction of this magnificent building, which they could never have afforded. And I think the analogy can be made to the present situation, where the legislators allowed this process to go forward a few years back. Of course, there were some questions raised about it in the most recent session, but it shows an example of leadership and thinking outside of the box to meet the needs of Texas. We needed a capital, and we got a capital by trading land for capital with an A and capital with an O, both of those things, to get this building built. If you think about the cost of congestion, obviously the number was mentioned earlier, $200 billion, and you know, that's pretty hard to get your arms around. What is $200 billion? What does that mean? You know, it's a number that's so enormous that it's hard to comprehend and bring it down to the level of business. And I thought about an example. Think about a service company that's operating today in Dallas-Fort Worth. And they have a fleet of vehicles, and typically there are two people who, you know, drive out to the job site or to the home or wherever they're going to provide whatever service they provide. There are two people in that truck or van. And let's say that, and I think this is probably fairly modest numbers, but let's say one is making $20 an hour and one is making $15 an hour. The helper is making the $15. So combined, you have a cost of about $35. Then you add the burden onto it, just in terms of direct costs, salaries, and then benefits. You know, and you think about the cost of an additional hour per workday. You're talking about some $15,000 a year just for that pair of workers, the price that the owner and the customers are paying for congestion to get that truck to the job site is an additional $15,000 a year. And that's a very narrow view of the cost, because it doesn't take into effect the cost associated with the delays and the timing, less time on the job site. Let's say that you're, you know, have a typical workday of 8 hours per day. You don't want to pay overtime. I always used to tell all my employees that I didn't know how to calculate overtime, so we try to discourage it, and most employers do. But if you assume 8 hours on the job from the time they leave their place of employment to the time they get back in the evening, and if an hour is consumed in congestion, then that means there's less time on the job site. Less work is being able to be done. And the time on the job and the days involved in completing whatever the project is increase greatly. The ability of businesses to service their customers in a timely manner is diminished by congestion. So it's not just the commute, if you will, but it's the day-to-day cost of operating business, the increased cost of running freight, delivering all kinds of services in the state. The tax is being paid. The tax is being paid by the people of Texas, whether they realize it or not. The tax is being paid by the businesses of Texas, whether or not they realize it or not. The tax is being paid. And obviously, the legislature and the leadership has been averse to raising the gas tax. We have, I think, Lawrence Olson, if he's in the room, can correct me, but I believe the only tax that I ever voted for was an increase in the gas tax back in 1984, because to me it was a worthwhile endeavor. Some of the money went to education. We can debate that, but the bulk of the money went to new road construction. And then the gasoline tax was raised again in 91. So we've had a period of some 16 years without any increase in the gas tax. And it was clearly stated by many speakers here, you've had an increase in efficiency of the vehicles and all kinds of things, obviously, over the years. So all of those factors together argue for the fact that relative to the need, less and less money is being created. It was stated, I believe, in 87 that transportation was about 30% of the state budget, and today it's about 8%. And, you know, we can argue the numbers till the cows come home with regard to the exact level of the need. But I think we could agree on one thing, that the need is not being met, and it's not being met to a large number. I mean, some say that Chairman Rick, I think, is quoted as saying that the only money that's created by the gas tax, all of that money goes to maintenance. Now, I've read some other numbers that some of it goes beyond that, but the point is it doesn't begin to create enough money to build the infrastructure necessary for Texas to keep moving. So Chairman Rick and his friends came up with the idea of the Trans-Texas Corridor, and they went about selling it, and they sold it, and the legislature passed it. In this last session, of course, some raised questions about it. And I think that, quite honestly, there was a very vocal, very small number of individuals who raised a lot of hell about the TTC, and that the legislature, you know, was in the process of backing away from it because of the criticism. But I think the numbers, an honest evaluation of the numbers, would indicate that this was a tiny minority. Some of the polling that I saw indicated that it didn't impact any of the elections last fall. You had, obviously, a very vocal opponent of the corridor out there running for office. And as I recall, she got about 20% of the vote. So I think the legislature overreacted to the problem, and to the point where actually legislation was passed, which the governor had to veto. Now, of course, we all know that when all was said and done, of course, as always, much more was said than done, but when all was said and done, a bill did pass to offer some scaled-back restrictions, if you will, on the idea of the private-public partnership. But what really happened, what a lot of people don't realize, is that by having this debate, by subjecting this concept, which we believe is a good one and a valid one, to such criticism, and even to the point where a bill was passed, which would have placed a moratorium on these projects into the future, we have said to potential investors, don't come to Texas. We have said, if you make an investment, there's a high level of uncertainty as to what the future will hold for you if you invest in Texas. Now, there is a limited amount of capital out there, folks, and there are a lot of projects across this great country of ours that are looking to bring this capital to their states. We don't want it to go there. We want it to come to Texas because it's a good way to build roads with non-tax dollars. Yet the legislature said, hold up there. So what did it do? It increased the cost of capital. It increased the uncertainty, and capital hates uncertainty. The markets hate uncertainty. They like a solid future. They like a long-term view of things as to how the money will be spent and their return on investment. It's all about return on investment. And when we place restrictions on the ability to negotiate deals that are in the best interest of the people of Texas, and I mean all the people of Texas, then we've increased the cost of capital and we've reduced the amount of capital that will come to the state. And I think to a large extent, people in this room and at this forum in general need to do a better job in terms of being heard at the legislature. Perhaps some of you are opponents. I don't know what the makeup of this room is in entirety, but I think that you were outshouted at the Texas legislature this last session, and I think that's unfortunate for the future of Texas. I mean, to me and to our organization, it's a win-win-win. We get people to bring capital to the state to build roads that people can drive on if they choose to and pay a toll for that road. To me, that's a winner. To me, as a business person, as an owner of a business for a number of years, we went out of our way to drive on the Dallas North Toll Road because we were reasonably certain that if we did so, it would be a very good investment of our 50 cents because it ensured us that we could get from point A to point B in a timely manner. So we went out of our way, because back in those days, 75 was a mess or was under construction. So we'd drive across town to get over there to use the darn thing to get north, because we knew the certainty of the fact that that road would typically be clear, and that we could get from point A to point B in a timely manner, and that we would more, you know, our investment would have an enormous rate of return for us by paying that toll. So if we have someone who's willing to come from Chicago or some other country and bring capital to the state, we should be at the border greeting them with open arms. The legislature failed to do this last session, and I think that's a mistake that will hurt us long term in our efforts to attract capital to the state and help build roads that will end the congestion. So my suggestion to you is that we need to continue to work. We need to be a loud voice, a louder voice, if you will, in the public arena with regard to the ability to build more roads and to use every tool that is available to us to do just that, so we'll reduce congestion, keep capital flowing to this state, and keep traffic flowing. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you, Bill. He brought that real home to us in real terms we can all understand. And as I recall, Chairperson, you probably remember this, the XIT, which brought us the rock for the Capitol, were investors from another state. So new Texans coming to Texas, and every day 1,000 people come to Texas bringing 800 cars with them. And we have a time for a couple of questions of this panel. And if you would, step over that microphone, and you might say what your name is so they know who they're talking to. And if you want to talk to all of them, that's fine. If you want to talk to just one of them, that's fine, too. So here we go.
Thank you for your presentations on congestion. I have, and we know that there are multiple factors involved. One of my questions for Jan, in the summer, most of us are breathing a sigh of relief because congestion goes down. Is anybody at the federal level working with Department of Education to partner with them and perhaps look at staggered start times for the younger children, which would significantly spread the peak in the morning hours?
I believe that's probably a short answer. They may be, I'm unaware of it, but that's an interesting idea, and I've noticed that even in the short time I've been here, how nice it is to travel in Austin in the summer. So I'll take that idea back. Thanks.
I'm going to interrupt and I'm going to ask Bill to help you with the answer to that question, because as you know, the demographics of Texas have changed. There are a lot of dual-income families, a lot of working women that have to take their kids to school and then get to the job, and that has an impact on business. So, Bill, can you kind of hit on that a little bit, too?
Well, I mean, I think there's been an effort to have a uniform school year in answer to your question. And, of course, the legislature last session did delay the start date, primarily driven by tourism. And like you say, in the summertime in Austin, when there ain't no UT and there ain't no public schools, it's a lot easier to get around this town. But wait till you have all three, the UT schools and the government shut down, then you really see what traffic is all about. But, you know, I would say that there's probably not much hope for that idea, because, you know, typically it would be a state issue rather than a federal issue, and that there's not the effort has been the other way.
All right. Thank you. Next question, please.
How you doing, panel? This is for the whole panel, whoever may be able to answer this. My name is Alan Atherton from the city of Los Fresnos, and as a taxpayer, too, I'd like to ask a question. I've heard through this forum many times about, you know, possibly increasing the gasoline tax. My question is what about, even if there was an increase in gasoline tax, what about the vehicle registration, vehicle inspection dollars that go into the budget? How does that co-mingle into the general funds and ways to get highways and roads built for this great state? And I agree that we also need to have some type of user fee, whether if it's, you know, for a port or airport or a highway, toll roads. But I was just trying to figure out how does all the taxes co-mingle just in transportation alone? There's three different ones. That was my question.
Well, we'll let Bill start, but I'll help him along a little bit. I'll help him along a little bit. You want to talk on that one?
Well, just at the beginning, I think I'm surprised after as many years as we have had a very significant increase on the registration fees for all vehicles that go into the Texas Emission Reduction Program, $20 additional for anyone in an ozone non-attainment county, which is our main urban counties around Dallas and Houston, and $15 for even all of us additional, and go into this grant program to, which is the legislature's a mandate, you know, to buy a significant portion, as I said, often 75% of heavy-duty construction equipment or heavy-duty vehicles. So it's not, it's for a good purpose to reduce emissions, but it's taking it out of, you know, the general use for road maintenance or construction.
Good answer.
I was just going to say, I mean, there's obviously not only that, but there's other, the money that's typically advertised to go to the highway fund is stolen. I mean, I'm not talking about this. I'm talking about through the appropriation process where I think Corona yesterday said some $300 million.
$1.5 billion over the next biennium.
Right. Is diverted. So, I mean, the first step in this would be to simply say, okay, let's be real legislators. Let's take the money that's advertised, collected for this specific purpose, go to the construction approach.
Absolutely, Bill, and I believe the numbers are for this next biennium are a little bit over $1.54 billion going to other state priorities other than transportation out of Fund 6. And I believe, to answer your question very bluntly and very pointedly, if you sum up all the taxes you pay in Texas, the Texas taxes, and you net out what goes to schools, you net out what goes to DPS and all those other things, and what goes back to the counties to help them with their roads, you get a little over $2.2, $2.3 billion for Texas highways. And it cost about $2.4 billion to maintain them. Absolutely. Yeah. Jan, did you want to touch on it?
No.
All right. Next. She says that's a state issue. All right. Next question.
Yes,
my name is Michelle Maksud, and I have actually two questions for Ms. Brown. One is as a citizen and one as an engineer. First one, I used to take a toll road. I had a previous job. I used to take a toll road, and you know, going back to my house, taking a toll road was just the same as taking a another free road. Just stop traffic all the way, huge parking lot. So I'm thinking, what am I doing on a toll road with traffic? I mean, I'm paying money for the privilege of sitting on that toll road. And you're going to say, well, what does that have to do with what I said? Well, I'm going to come back. I'm talking about now. I live in Houston on 290. I have to take 290, and I watch the HOV lane move fairly okay where the other lanes are clogged. When we convert HOV to HOT, are we going to have the same problem? Are we going to have another parking lot also with a whole bunch of cars getting on the HOT? That's one, and I'll just guess it now, okay? Question two was, just as an engineer, I'm curious, and you might not know the answer. How do we get the different percentages of what's attributable to, you know, like 15% for, I don't remember the percentages, you know, like the events are this much, increased capacity is like 40%. I'm curious as to how we came up with that.
All right, Jan, jump on that.
The first question, one thing I would do in an overall response is to invite you to look at the website on a lot of the guidance on HOV to hot lanes. What I would tell you is that the purpose of the HOV lane, high occupancy vehicle, is still there, and there's a responsibility and onus on the state or the local public agency that's in control of that facility to monitor and evaluate the operations of that facility. If the operations were to diminish to the point that it was impacting the operation, then you'd start seeing either some pricing going on, some variable pricing, to try to get the efficiency of that lane to continue. But there would be an active management process in there to keep that lane moving and keep the benefits still there. So it would be either with the additional pricing for the toll vehicles Or there would be, as in HOVs today, you might be looking at increasing the ridership within a vehicle. I'm not sure that's happened anywhere. Usually we've been looking at HOV2 as being the number that we're looking at. But there would be processes in place to try to better manage that lane, but I would tell you it's an active management responsibility to keep that going. With response to your second question on how we determine that, a lot of that is dependent on the data that's collected by the states and the local agencies, and a lot of it is done in the work that they do in their congestion processes and collecting data on accident data, what's anticipated there. So I can tell you it's probably the best guess out there, but certainly a start at what we're seeing out there. But a lot of that data is coming from the state itself or the local communities that are out there getting it.
Good answer. What I heard you say is you need more toll lanes so you can move faster. She's not going to give us any money to do it, so we're going to have to build them out of our revenue. We're going to have to do it ourselves in Texas. We're going to have to build more roads. The esteemed Tom Griebel. Yes, sir.
Hey, I'm Tom Griebel with Pape Dawson Engineers. Give you a perspective. I did enjoy all your remarks. Bill, I do want to comment. It's fortunate in the late 1800s that they didn't consider Chicago Spaniards at the time, or we would have never built the Capitol. I do have a question for Chairman White. If on your program for the TERP, which is the Texas Emission Reduction Program, and since we all pay when we buy used or new vehicles, we pay that $15. If you're looking for program ideas, what would you consider or your perspective on trying to move some of that money? You indicated it went from 125 to 175, and you think it's grown to 200 million. It's probably going to continue to grow. To move some of that money into that Texas Rail Relocation and Improvement Fund, so you can reduce some of the idling and at the crossings, as well as improve the throughput of the trains, train speeds, a different type of program rather than one diesel truck at a time, but look at a systems approach to kind of solving some of our emission issues, as well as congestion issues.
That's a really interesting idea. To give you kind of a dull, simple answer, I think that would be more than a stretch under the existing statutory rubrics. However, I think there's a way to look at that. For instance, of all the money spent to date, which is like $400 million, the amount every year keeps growing and will do $400 million probably in the next 2 years, but nonetheless something like $400 million. I think 50% to 60% went to the locomotive sector for either buying new switcher engines or for retrofits on those, and the reason that happened, and I was very surprised and really wanted to avoid it. I just didn't think the intention of all this money was really to go to the railroads. But we saw the greatest, when we calculated the emission reductions, the greatest bang for the buck for reducing those diesel emissions. And they had to remain in a switcher yard. They couldn't be a locomotive that's going to California. It has to stay here and be operated. But that's a really interesting thing. That might be a better way to spend what we spent, probably well over $250 million on buying new locomotives, switcher engine locomotives, or retrofits for saying. Interesting.
Do we have any more questions? If not, we'd really like to thank you for your attention today. And before you leave, there are some evaluation sheets on your seat we'd like you to fill out. The next session starts at 10:15. We have a wonderful speaker at lunch today. But if you would, please thank each of our speakers as you can on your way out the door. And let's please give them one hand. Thank you.
Thank you so much.